Chapter 2. The Brutal Truth. Grow or Die. Every business owner wants his or her business to grow, right? Actually, the truth is that many don't. And I may be talking about you. Perhaps they're afraid of losing the company culture. They'll say, "We like the size we are. We're not concerned about growing. We prefer to focus on maintaining our level of expertise. We don't want to go heavy on the business side of things." At a national conference of professional services firms I attend each year, the focus is on business management. The CEO roundtable is conducted to discuss hot topics. The moderator creates a flip chart to record key topics, and the participants vote on the most popular topics. Growth is almost always one of them. The moderator once began the discussion by saying, "Of course, everybody wants to grow." Several people raised their hands, and when the moderator acknowledged them, they informed him that their firms did not choose growth at all. They were content with the way things were. They had zero interest in growing, and that was that. Taking it one step further, the moderator asked for a show of hands from other CEOs in the group who were not interested in growing their firms. Quite a few hands went up. It was clear that, contrary to what you hear in numerous conference presentations, articles, and books, not everyone considers growth a priority. Does this attitude have negative consequences? Definitely. This mindset of contentment lulls executives into a dangerous state of complacency, as the following true story demonstrates. Why good enough isn't. Jim was a project engineer who lived a few miles from work. En route to his office, he encountered several stop signs. At first, he was diligent and stopped fully at each one. Then one day, those stops became rolling stops. After all, Jim thought, there really are no consequences of a harmless rolling stop, particularly if one is careful to look left and then right before moving on. One morning, he was aggravated. He had an argument with his son that caused him to leave for work late. As he drove to the office in an agitated state, one of those rolling stops became more rolling than stop. He did not look carefully left and right before proceeding into the intersection, and bang, he was T-boned. The other car careened across the intersection and into a fence. Jim jumped out of his car to check on the other driver. She seemed okay, save for a burn on her forehead from the airbag, but her car was totaled. She was taken by ambulance to a hospital as a precaution. Jim didn't hear much more about it after that. His insurance company paid for the damages. He was given a ticket, but it was just a loss of a few dollars. No real harm was done except for a short delay getting to work. Nevertheless, a month later he reflected on his habit of rolling through stop signs and how his cavalier attitude about traffic regulations and safe driving had caused problems for him and for somebody else. While it hadn't been catastrophic, what if something terrible had happened? What if that person had been horribly injured? Why, Jim thought, I might be in jail. This story illustrates the danger of the "we don't want to grow" attitude. For a while, everything seems fine. But eventually, the day will come when a slip-up will ruin you. Jim had been cruising along in the good enough zone, and his complacency had made him vulnerable to disaster. If we get stuck in the good enough zone, one day our luck will run out, and we will slip. Avoiding failure requires continuous learning and improvement. This means creating a learning culture. Convey to your team that the good enough zone is dangerous. Instead, you should be forever striving toward excellence. In his book, Blue Threat, Tony Kern describes the good enough zone using a stairway metaphor. Envision a stairway that transects three floors. The bottom floor is the failure zone, and the top floor is peak performance. This staircase crosses a middle floor labeled the good enough zone. The good enough zone deludes you into believing you're doing well, even though you have not grown in terms of revenue or profit, number of employees, reputation, or diversification of services offered. You've just kept going the way you are. You are not interested in the world around you, a world that's changing daily. You're not paying attention to risk and vulnerabilities, which can include key employee departures, key clients leaving, and changing performance standards. Kern stresses that it is critical to pay attention both to what you can control and what you cannot control. As a former Air Force commander, he knew that sometimes we are our own worst enemy. Our own mistakes and oversights can derail the mission as much as our adversary's actions. And that is exactly what happened to Jim. This means your own complacency and carelessness can doom you. Merely remaining content is tantamount to backsliding, because while you are static, everyone else races past you in the pursuit of excellence. The key to sustainability is momentum. The important thing is to always be climbing the stairs, even if slowly. Always be seeking to improve. Your survival depends on your willingness to grow and your knowledge of how to do it safely. Imprisoned in the stocks. What are some of the consequences of not growing? No growth in the traditional sense means you're not enhancing your profitability, which creates financial hardships because your stock doesn't go up. There's no market for it. If stock value doesn't increase, there's no internal demand for the stock. It makes distributing ownership among employees problematic. The benefit of distributing ownership is that you're doing some advanced planning for internal succession and for current owners. A privately owned firm needs to transfer stock to others, usually incrementally. But no growth in stock deters people from investing in the company. Many companies then end up heavily subsidizing the stock price purchase, which diverts some of their profits into those subsidies. For owners, this has a cost. And if there still isn't a sufficient rate of return from the employee's viewpoint, employees who would be buying the stock, then it's not a long-term sustainable solution. What's more, owner retirement can come into play. If one or more owners want to retire or move into other careers and the staff isn't motivated and ambitious, the owners have no one who can take over the management of the company. At that point, the only solution is to dissolve the company or to sell it. Selling it might provide an owner with an exit strategy, but it often leads to instability and other problems for the remaining employees. It's very difficult to have a succession plan in a company that has a poor track record of growth. And if selling is the goal, the price a buyer is willing to pay is based on profitability and specific growth trends. If the company is flatlining, the sale price is going to be much lower than it should be. Gone. Another consequence of anemic revenue growth is that these firms tend to have high turnover because they do not provide opportunities for advancement. Your product is your people, and you must keep them. If every employee is hoping to advance and the company is not growing, promotion can only happen when someone leaves or retires. But if there is a high turnover, that brings its own set of problems. If too many people are departing, it is hard to maintain consistent performance on client deliverables. It also forces some staff members to allocate an inordinate amount of time to the hiring process. Moreover, each time a new hire comes in, there's a possibility he or she may not work out, which generates even more overhead costs. The ripple effect of growth stagnation is a business staffed with unmotivated, mediocre employees. There are exceptions, but as a rule, those who remain tend to be underperforming individuals who lack drive and ambition. For the record, I am not talking about the work-life balance that has become increasingly important to millennials and many other highly qualified professionals. I'm talking about employees who may be stuck in the good enough zone. They are not keeping up with new technologies, participating in training, pitching ideas, or generally improving themselves and their value to the company. And hence, they are not contributing to the company's value overall. They tend to be comfortable simply sitting back and having assignments handed to them by a few principals. In all fairness, individuals in professional services go to college for a technical reason, to become engineers, environmental scientists, architects, planners, accountants, or lawyers, not to become salespeople, and not necessarily to learn new ways of thinking and approaching things. It takes vision and experience in implementing growth strategies to light the kind of fire under them that propels them into growth mode. The Lonely Marketer. I know a prominent marketing director from a 60-person engineering firm on Long Island, New York. Because neither principals nor staff members are engaged in any kind of growth process, the marketing director does everything. She develops client relationships through multiple face-to-face meetings and undertakes follow-up meetings to sign clients. She works with them to develop opportunities, determine the scope of work to be done, and present contracts. When she brings questions back to the office, the firm's principals help her address technical issues that are not her bailiwick, although, frankly, I'm not sure what isn't her bailiwick. But they do not get involved in selling, preferring to remain strictly technical people. Given the depth and scope of her responsibilities, I asked her how big the firm was now as opposed to 10 years ago. She responded that it was about the same. I then inquired about the firm's turnover rate, assuming that with the kind of outreach she was doing, it would be low. "We have a very high turnover rate," she answered. "We're always having people leave. We're always hiring new people." So the firm was not growing, and its principals didn't want to take responsibility for generating new business, instead putting the onus on a lone marketing person with limited technical education and understanding. Apparently, she is one of very few in the firm with any level of motivation, burdened with keeping the firm afloat, but apparently not ascendant, try as she might. Pressure and prerogatives. Another consequence of no growth is poor client retention and vulnerability to client whims. Clients may change their procurement practices, or they may suddenly require new skill sets for their technical needs. If a company sustains itself strictly on a loyal client base, and for some reason a client moves to a competitor, that client can be very hard to replace. The risk that a client may leave rises if the client has become attached to a single employee, for example, a principal or senior project manager. The client may have more allegiance to the individual than to the firm as a whole, possibly because the firm has not taken the time to introduce the client to other employees with different skill sets. The client then associates the firm with expertise on whatever specific service is being provided by that principal or senior project manager, and looks elsewhere when thinking about a different project with different requirements. If the principal with the client relationship leaves to start up a new firm, or the senior project manager leaves for any other reason, the client may easily follow that individual out. So not only does the firm in a no-growth mode lose a staff member, it also loses a client. Vulnerability to client whims is also a problem when catering to price-sensitive clients, whose focus is on always trying to do things for less. This squeezes margins, increases overhead, and diminishes the staff's opportunity to work on diverse and stimulating projects. Adapting and Shifting. Commoditization. A significant consequence of lack of growth is an inability to adapt to evolving client needs. Talent and skills tend to be static in a firm that doesn't grow. And when new technologies come along, the employees of such firms often do not become familiar with them quickly enough. Clients expect you to keep current and may turn to your competitors if they sense that you are not. A firm caught in this predicament will sometimes offer to get up to speed, but it may not be able to change quickly enough to provide what's needed. And it becomes harder to adapt when you have lots of people stuck in their roles without opportunities for advancement. Not anticipating and preparing for market shifts is another extremely dangerous consequence of failure to grow. Uber and Lyft are stellar examples of companies that seized the day when it came to market shifts, and I will talk about them later in the chapter. In his book, The Fourth Industrial Revolution, World Economic Forum founder Klaus Schwab makes the case that in the digital age, the period of change we are living through is more significant and the ramifications of the latest technological revolution more immense than any prior period of human history. The changes are so profound, he says, that from the perspective of human history, there has never been a time of greater promise or potential peril. My concern, however, is that decision makers are too often caught in traditional, linear, and non-disruptive thinking, or too absorbed by immediate concerns to think strategically about the forces of disruption and innovation shaping our future. In the digital age, we're witnessing a dramatic evolution of artificial intelligence, AI. Robots that are able to do the jobs humans do, such as taking items off of the shelf, packing them in boxes, and shipping them from a warehouse. By the time the item ends up at your doorstep, the driver who delivers might be virtually the only human being who has been involved. But with the use of drones as delivery vehicles, even that is changing. Because change is happening so fast, there is concern that common classes of jobs, retail salespeople in stores, medical personnel, people who do the field data collection, common in engineering and architecture, will soon go away. Drones are used increasingly for aerial surveillance of freeways, which means that traffic reporters and the helicopter pilots who escort them will one day fade away too. But the professional services industry is historically very slow to recognize these changes and adapt to them. Very large firms with 5,000 to 10,000 employees have whole departments that track trends and figure out ways to adapt. But 90% of the firms in this country lack the resources and ability to adapt in this way, which makes them susceptible to the kinds of market shifts outlined in Schwab's book. And if they are unprepared, they could conceivably go out of business. With the mentality that being in a good enough zone is, well, good enough, failure becomes destiny rather than something they can anticipate and avoid. To date, Uber and Lyft are the companies that have best exploited market shifts in the transit industry. They have left traditional taxis in the dust, all because they saw around corners when smartphone development disrupted the way people do things. Uber and Lyft understood that hundreds of thousands of apps are available to anyone with a smartphone, and that such apps are easy for technology companies to create, meaning that getting from point A to point B was a new multi-billion-dollar industry waiting to happen. Sure, these companies have had growing pains, but the bottom line is that they saw what was coming and were able to capitalize on it. Unfortunately, taxi companies did not see this coming. Had they operated in a less short-sighted manner, they might have identified this trend and adapted to it. This example demonstrates how professional services firms can and will become victims of external disruption unless they decide to pay attention and evolve. That in itself is an opportunity and a challenge. How do you do this if you're a small firm. There are ways to anticipate market shift, putting safe growth strategies into place, which we will explore further on in the book. These can include studying other companies that are thought leaders, seeing what has worked for them, noting the mistakes they have made, and striving to avoid those mistakes. Understanding why changes are occurring, deciding which innovations look as though they're sustainable, and determining how they apply to your firm are all important components of growth. And this can be done without a huge, risky investment. At the annual American Council of Engineering Companies, ACEC, conference, I taught a seminar on how firms of all sizes can anticipate and adapt to market shifts, how to size up what's going on not only within your industry, but also outside of it. That information is part of any safe growth strategy. Social Change, A Conscience by Any Other Name. Growth and adaptation to change require more than just a willingness to keep abreast of trends in technology and consumer behavior. Society is changing, and in the last couple of decades, more and more individuals, including prospective talent and clients, have opted to work for and with firms that have a social conscience over those that don't. In their 2007 book, Firms of Endearment, How World-Class Companies Profit from Passion and Purpose, authors Rajendra Sisodia, David B. Wolf, and Jagdish N. Sheth introduced the concept of conscious leadership and suggested that humane companies are the ones blazing the fastest trails to the top. Long-term competitive advantage, the authors posit, is measured in terms of value that matters: emotional, experimental, social, and financial. Another of Sisodia's books, Conscious Capitalism, Liberating the Heroic Spirit of Business, co-authored with Whole Foods CEO John McKay, takes the theme of socially responsible business practices even further. Sisodia and McKay both sit on the board of directors of Conscious Capitalism, an organization dedicated to promoting ethical, sustainable business practices, and the notion that such practices are good for business. And these values are catching on. Today, Conscious Capitalism has 40 chapters worldwide. When you think about change and innovation, which lead to growth, it's impossible to overlook the impact a social conscience has on a business, especially when thriving businesses in the S&P 500 are embracing these values. A commitment to growth can lead to a sustainable business that attracts and retains human capital and fuels demand for company stock ownership. Ideally, firms should look at growing from every angle, but even executing one or two strategies can enable you to stay relevant. Of course, you also need to be able to effectively execute those strategies without getting caught up in the day-to-day demands of your business, something I'll discuss in the next chapter.